This episode of the Global Kidney Care Podcast is supported by Baxter and was recorded in person at the ISN's World Congress of Nephrology 2024 in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this podcast. I'm just going to introduce myself and my colleagues here. So my name's Helen Hurst. I'm based in the UK. I'm a clinical academic and I work as a professor of nursing and a consultant nurse. We are doing a podcast this morning about shared decision making. So I'll just hand over to Rachel and Anna to introduce themselves.
Good morning, I'm Rachel Walker. I'm an associate professor and nurse practitioner in New Zealand and really happy to be here on the Shared Decision Making podcast.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Ana Figueiredo. I'm professor of nursing in Brazil and have been working with PD patients for a long time.
Speak for yourself, Anna. Anyway, we are here today to have a conversation, really, about shared decision making. I think just to set the scene for everybody, we're all aware how important shared decision making is. We all should be familiar with the model of shared decision making. We all strive to achieve it. And I think so that we can get a conversation going, we're going to talk about shared decision making, particularly when we are with patients when they're making decisions about choices of modality, whether to have dialysis, what type of dialysis, or not to have dialysis. And I think we're all nurses. We work as professionals, as clinicians. So when I use the word clinician, I think, I'm referring to nurses, doctors, whoever that person is, sat with a patient and their family. So we bring our own preferences to the table. We bring the knowledge and information. So we hold all the cards, really, in a way that we've got that information. Obviously, the patients and families have their own preferences. So I think to start off with, we're going to talk about why it is important to follow a model of shared decision-making, particularly around modality selection. So, Rachel, do you want to go first?
Yeah, so from my perspective, why it's important to have shared decision-making is our job is to educate and inform patients and their families about decisions. We have a set of skills in order to do that. And what we need to do, why it's important is to, if we inform patients and educate them, then they can make a good decision in collaboration with us. If we don't do that and we don't have good decision-making, then things go wrong generally. Patients don't get what they want. They're disappointed in the treatment. They have different expectations of what we're going to offer them. So by having shared decision-making, we improve the patient journey.
I don't think there is much more to add, but I think on myself, would I like someone to decide anything for me? Probably not. And that's sometimes what we do for patients, deciding for them. And think as yourself, as an adult, you want to participate. And if you know what you're doing, you're probably going to adhere more to your treatment. You collaborate, you're part of it. So I think it's engaging the patients in what's best for them, not for us. That's the important thing to do for the patients.
I think that's a good point about how we would personally want to make decisions for ourselves. So I think that brings me to thinking about what might be those, we might think that we're not making decisions for people. What are the sorts of things and challenges from our perspective that we might bring to the table? So our own bias and how is that challenging so that we can make sure that we're not making those decisions?
I think the main challenge is sometimes in our own biases, assuming we know better than the patients and their families or making assumptions about them. So what we do in my unit in New Zealand is we have advanced kidney nurses who, when patients are preparing for dialysis or transplantation or not to have dialysis or transplantation, the advanced kidney nurses go and do a home visit. Yep. So they assess the patient with their family, if possible, in the home. They complete a really thorough assessment, which looks at the home situation, the patient's goals, physical assessment so they understand actually what the patient is capable of, but also their goals and what they want from the treatment. They give them education about all the different modality options, and then they talk to them about their preliminary thoughts. There's no pressure on the patient at that stage to make a decision, and then we get them back to clinic. By then, we've got the report from the advanced kidney nurses. We're able to understand a bit more detail about the patient and their family and their goals, and we can talk through again and re-educate, re-inform them, make sure they understand, and start talking about in more detail the advantages and disadvantages of each option. That way we can together make a recommendation, because we know the patient and family well enough to do that, but we're doing that in collaboration with them.
I'll talk about Brazil, but yeah. I believe most of South America would be the same. We usually get patients late referral, so time for decision-making is not preparing as you do in New Zealand, that you have been with this patient for a long time, you have time to do home visit. We get the patient like maybe needing to start dialysis in the next week or even a month after that, and we just have to break some barriers. In a majority of Latin America, you have most hemodialysis, so they are not familiar with other kind of therapy. So it's breaking the barrier to say there is other option. Why they haven't heard of it? Because, you know, it's more difficult for us to offer it. And sometimes I feel like convincing the patient that there is something that he should consider, and taking in consideration his lifestyle would be better for him. But because he haven't heard of that, and it's a short time, and the doctor sometimes say you just need to go into dialysis. So unfortunately, we face a different way to approach the decision-making, sometimes just doing a visit, explaining the pros and cons of each therapy. It's not the same. I wish we had something like that. You may have in one or two places that they have this preparation, or if they're on a private clinic, but in general, that's not our reality.
Okay, so it's that what you've described may be the case in many other parts of the world, actually, that we don't have the luxury. We're very similar to New Zealand in the UK, that we do try to spend a lot of time in that decision making. It's not just a one-off conversation, it's the assessments, it's the preparation, checking that people understand. But obviously, when people arrive late in a referral, then it does make it more difficult. And I think, do you think there's challenges then that if somebody is a late referral, we do see that, we obviously do see that, and people sometimes end up starting dialysis in an acute way, often hemodialysis, going back then to do the shared decision making. Do you do that in New Zealand, Rachel? So for your, you know,
yeah, so we still do get a large percentage of our patients who are late referrals, or what we sometimes deem crash landers, so they need to start acutely. And we try and work backwards, so we still will try and do an assessment of them. But it is more difficult, it is a barrier, particularly because we encourage home dialysis a lot more. Once patients are comfortable in the in-centre facility setting, it's much harder to show them different options. They feel quite safe there often with the nursing support. So it is a little bit more difficult to build that confidence, because once you know something, you're really familiar with it and you're in a happy place there. So that is definitely a barrier, but we still go through the process. And another good thing that we do often as we can is peer support. So we'll get patients to talk to other patients who've had a similar experience so that they can understand it from the patient perspective, and the feedback from patients is that's really valuable.
We do try to go and talk to the patient once they start hemodialysis, trying to make an appointment, trying to show different modalities. But I believe the most successful case we have is when we get patients on PD that come in for a consultation, just, can you talk to this patient? We see the potential. We see the benefit for them to go on PD. Can you go there and see how your life is now, how different you can still work? And that seems to work much better than from when nurses or doctors trying to talk about different modalities. So, and the case we have success usually was in this way: get patients to talk to patients without the bias of having peritonitis. So, you know, all these bad things we patients hear about PD.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because often we think, I think as clinicians, that we're telling them what's important. But actually, when they talk to other patients, the questions they ask and the things that the patients tell other patients are important are completely different from what we would tell them. So less clinical, more just about how their daily lives are.
Yeah, we've touched on that. It's kind of getting to know the patient and the family before you even talk about dialysis and the complexities of dialysis, is understanding that person, where they're at in their life and what is important. But what I want to ask is, how do you reconcile, and because I struggle with this sometimes, that you meet a patient, it seems like a decision has been made. You think, and we've talked about this, you actually think, actually, I think they might be better with A or B, or whether that's trying a different dialysis modality or not having dialysis. How do you reconcile with that? How do you deal with that in a clinic situation? So to bring back the conversation about the decision, revisiting the decision.
In my clinics that I run, I always revisit the decisions. So because people's lives change, their priorities change over time. Sometimes, and this is some of our advantage, we see patients 2 years before they need to start. So things can change, particularly in the older patient over that time. So we revisit it. I always reassure patients that this nothing's set in stone. It's a fluid decision, that they have the ability to change their mind, that our job is really to make sure that they have the best decision for them at that time. So I think just continuing to educate, inform, and support the patients really in their goals.
I think one of the most difficult things to do is change patients' mind when they have the information, probably not the complete one, scenario from the doctors saying that's best for you. And usually in South America, Brazil would be, you should go to hemodialysis. So trying to explain to the patients, usually say, why are you choosing it? Oh, the doctor said they'll have to do every single day. Then I put like adding up the hours you're going to do PD and adding the hours you're going to be involved in hemodialysis, making the calculation. Do you think that takes longer? Oh, no. And then I go like argument by argument, comparing the two modalities and make the patient realize maybe it's not so clear for me. I won't say you should do it, but let me understand why you're not doing it. And usually it's timing consuming because they've been told that PD should be 7 days a week, every day, and hemodialysis 3 times a week. So it's a short involvement. But if added, how many hours you be waiting room, going, moving from your home to the hospital, the numbers adding up is longer than be involved at your place. So usually it's that kind of conversation that I have. Tell me why not.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to say, well, you could look at this way and it's not the same, is it? Mm. You're going to work 3 days a week. Can you imagine that you can be working every single day? We can arrange your PD exchange or APD to suit you. So that's a kind of way to do it, trying to patient things in a different way.
And I think, because one of the things as well to think about in all of this is, if we think of challenges and we think of equity and equitable access to information and education, some of the challenges we have often in the UK is language barriers, people from different backgrounds. And sometimes I do worry they're not getting the same equal access to that information and understanding. And what's been interesting here at the conference the last few days is, you know, things like health literacy and all those things that we think would be a barrier, but is a barrier for understanding. So just how do you deal with the challenge, you know, how do we tackle this inequity, which we know is out there, which could be language, it could be educational level, it could be lots of things, so that we can approach the shared decision making with the right tools so that we can ensure patients and families are getting all the information culturally appropriate or language appropriate.
I think the key is to make sure that your education is individualised, so depends on the patient. So you may need a translator. Some people will, and we often ask people, how do you learn the best? Is it by watching? Is it by reading? And we have the ability then to tailor the information. So it might just be talking through treatments, or it might be that they have someone who has good literacy and they want to read every study that's been designed ever, or they might just want to watch videos to visually see. We use dummy mannequins as well sometimes so they can visually have practice with PD, for example. We'll take them into the dialysis unit. Again, talking to patients is a different way. So I think there's lots of different ways we can try and educate. As long as it's individualised for that person, then we just keep trying to do our best. And again, that's a fluid process, so mm-hmm. we can change it as many times as we need to.
That's a good point, because when you think about Europe, New Zealand, Australia, or other places where you have such a standard to put patients on PD, and that's why probably it strikes you, we can put any patient here in PD if they want. We do assess them, but we don't take as a limitation. We see if you don't have this kind of housing, how can you manage it? How we can organize for you to do it? If you don't have potable water, maybe we have a gallon of water that you can wash your hands. So it's a different approach, I believe, is trying to make sure how we can provide the conditions for these patients to have this therapy. Otherwise, yes. It's not going to be an equitable decision, because if you don't have housing or if you can't learn, you stuck to hemodialysis. And that should not be the case. We should, as you said, individualize training things, but the important thing is how can we help the patient make sure they can do the therapy they chose with the resource they have, even if they live in the mountains or in a shanty town, whatever. How can we make it happen for the patient?
Yeah.
Guaranteeing quality.
Yeah. Well, I think that those are our barriers, aren't they? We often put those barriers in place. I think that's not... that's not the patient's back. We see that as a barrier, or we assume that that's a barrier. And I think Rachel's point about individualised is absolutely critical. And we do have to think that the way that we provide the education and information is not the same for everybody. And everybody might need a slightly different approach. And, you know, people with learning disabilities or anything, we have to be able to adapt how we give that information and ensure that we know we have really delivered a shared decision-making process.
I was just going to add that sometimes we think of them as barriers, but actually what they are is they're challenges for us to have workarounds. And if we stop thinking about them being barriers to particularly PD and start thinking about challenges, then we can overcome them. And that then provides solution for patients rather than... It's sometimes easy to say no because we see them as barriers, but actually we can often work around most things to get patients home.
And I would say that in South America and Brazil, it's much easier to say no because you have the literature supporting from the outsider, from the different backgrounds. They say, no, you need these standards. So if you don't have it here, it's no. But it's not this way. We can do it. We can have this chance and change things, even getting to help patients organize themselves. But the barrier is much easier to say, no, you can't do PD. You have to be on hemodialysis, or you can,
And I think we have to accept sometimes that people will make decisions. We might in our head be thinking, I don't know if that's the right one, but that's okay. That's something we have to kind of just support people with and through. I think just to kind of wrap things up a little bit and try and, get us to some key points, I think if there's some messages that we want to give to everybody about shared decision-making and what you feel that you think is important or anything that you want to share? I think I'll start with you, Anif, on that one.
I think the most important is listen to the patient, trying to understand what's happening in his life at this moment. Thinking again on the late referral, it's too much information. So you need to give them time to process the information given. So you cannot ask them for have a decision now. You have to provide information, listen, what their goals. They want to. They have family, they want to see the growth of the young lady or get their daughter married. What's the goal? So need some time to get to know the patient, but the important thing before you approaching is giving time and listen, what do you know so far? How I can help you to make take decision. I think that's the important thing. When you don't have all these line that patient go for 1 year, 2 years, getting the information. If you have little time to do, just listen, trying to understand how you can provide some information to have a better decision making.
Thanks, Anna.
And I guess I completely agree with Anna. Otherwise, I think the main things from my perspective are individualized and varied education and repetitive education at any stage. Because even when someone's made a decision, they can always change their mind, and we need to support that. And that might be a positive change, that they want to change a modality that we think is probably better for them or that we recommend, or it might be a negative one. But the important thing is that we keep educating and we keep understanding their goals, like Anna said, and just keep making sure that the patient understands the pros and cons of each situation.
That's great. So we're saying we have to listen to patients, we have to individualise it, and I think I would just add as well then that we also reflect ourselves. Each time we are in that scenario, that we're constantly reflecting and thinking about our own unconscious bias and how we might be leading that conversation. And I think, you know, your point about listening is absolutely key. And we are very privileged, aren't we, that we can build relationships with patients and families so we can get to know them. And that getting to know them is all part of the shared decision-making process. So I think we have covered everything I think that we could. Though, I mean, we could talk about this all day, couldn't we, really? We could give case scenarios, but I think we've got the nuggets, really, of what we feel is really important in shared decision-making. So thank you, everybody. Hope you enjoy listening to our perspectives, and we're going to go and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to my guests.